The Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Treasurer, goodbye.
Good morning. Go ahead and be seated. All right. The first matter on calendar this morning, Venisi versus State. Quails?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, for the record, my name is Tom Qualls. At council table, Scott Edwards, and we represent petitioner appellate in this case, Sayosi Venisi. With court's indulgence, I'm going to take the enumerated issues a little out of order, starting first with the Rohan issues. First question there is whether the district court erred in finding that Venisi was competent to proceed with the post-conviction petition pursuant to the Rohan decision from the Ninth Circuit. This first prong is going to be difficult, not impossible, for this court to affirm, and here's why. Number one, it's based upon an inadequate record. Number two, it is based upon conflicting evidence, and as is required by this court, that conflicting evidence or the resolution of that conflicting evidence is not supported by the requisite substantial evidence standard set forth by decisions of this court going back to 1976. Two mental health professionals were appointed pursuant to our Rohan motion to evaluate Mr. Venisi. One was a psychiatrist, Dr. Bidker, another one was a psychologist, Dr. Amazaga. The psychologist upon whom the district court relied heavily based part of his decision, well, his evaluation, his testing of Mr. Venisi was a secret test, the results of which, the analysis of which, all of which was kept in secret from the tribunal, making the court's reliance upon that testimony based upon an incomplete record. Additionally, the court based her decision upon the opinion of the psychologist who could not evaluate the effect of the medication on Mr. Venisi. And thirdly, the district court relied upon her own observation of Mr. Venisi smiling at a joke to determine that he was competent. Regarding the secret test employed by Dr. Amazaga, which makes the record incomplete, I would point the court to two U.S. Supreme Court decisions. One, Gardner v. Florida from 1977, in which a death sentence was upheld by an appellate court based in part, the sentence itself was based in part upon a pre-sentence report. That report was sealed and was not reviewed by the appellate court. The U.S. Supreme Court said that was constitutional error. Second is Dobbs v. Zant from 1993. There was a sentencing transcript, part of which was missing in the appellate record. The appellate court affirmed that death sentence again without reviewing that part of the sentencing transcript. The U.S. Supreme Court again said, this is not permissible. It's a constitutional error. The findings by Dr. Bidker, the psychiatrist, included that Mr. Venisi was not competent to participate in these proceedings or to assist counsel, that he did not fully understand the role of defense counsel, that the medicines that he was receiving was having an impact on his competency, and that it would be difficult, if not impossible, if you were not a psychiatrist, to make sense of what Venisi was saying. Given these facts, given the incomplete record, given the fact that the psychologist could not opine as to the medicine's effect, the district court's decision is not based upon substantial evidence.
So what should have happened? What should have happened, according to you?
What should have happened? What should have happened is, well, under the standard, if there's a conflict in the two professionals, whatever decision the district court makes needs to be based upon substantial evidence. It can't be based upon an incomplete record. It can't be based upon, if the decision is, and here was the recommendation from Bidker to cut to the chase, the medicines are in part adding to competency. Let's change the medicines. I want to revisit this in 90 days. I'll do a new eval. We'll come back before the court. That's all he was saying. Now, I don't know if Your Honor was skipping ahead as to what is the remedy. The remedy, to jump to that point, at least according to all of the circuits that have reviewed this, is you have to stay the proceedings until he becomes competent. Now, again, that depends upon the facts of the case.
Mr. Qual, what if the court, this court, rejects the rationale in Rowan? What if this court rejects the rationale in Rowan?
So I'll take that as a question is, what is the source of the right to be competent during the capital habeas proceedings?
There.
And that right, although Rohan is based upon an interpretation of federal statutes, and I'm sure Mr. McCarthy is going to bang away at that, but Nevada's rights for capital habeas litigants actually exceed that the federal courts give. Not only are you required to have counsel, but Crump makes it quite clear that you're required to have the effective assistance of counsel, which then, of course, brings in the Sixth Amendment, which brings in due process. And so the rights that we have are not, or the rights that are discussed in Rohan are not unique. They're also applicable here in the state by statute, and again, they're expanded here. We actually have the effective assistance of counsel right on the first capital habeas.
But the state argues that that can be addressed through next of friend petitions like Calambro.
I would say so. To compare and contrast with Calambro, the issues in Calambro are not the issues here. The standard of competency is different. The standard of competency and the issue in Calambro was, the right to waive an attorney, the right to waive counsel. And what is the standard of competency to waive that, right? Here we're talking about the same right as the same competence standard as the competency to proceed to trial. Because when you're talking about post-conviction habeas, you're talking about a burden of proof shifting. So at trial,
but you would concede, wouldn't you, Mr. Qual, that there is no constitutional source for competency in post-conviction habeas litigation?
I would not concede that. I would not concede that, and I don't think that that is what Crump says. I think that in the state of Nevada, there is the right to effective assistance of counsel, which necessarily includes the right to competency, because you can't have effective counsel unless there's adequate, reasonable communication with the petitioner, and especially if you're talking about such things as ineffective assistance of counsel, because these are things that are often not on the record, especially in this case. In this case, there were all kinds of communications that went on, apparently, between counsel and Venisi that led to this conflict, that led to them trying to get off the case, all of which is not on the record and requires Venisi's rational and reasonable participation in order to communicate with us so that we can be effective under Crump. So I think I've covered the standard. I think I've covered the appropriate remedy there. I'll move into the ineffective assistance, which is actually part of a bigger structural error. Because of the communication that allegedly went between Venisi and his counsel in this case. And by the way, I'll slip this in. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I could.
All right.
Because of that communication, defense counsel felt that they had an ethical duty that put them in an actual conflict state. They did not take this upon themselves, but actually went to bar counsel a number of times and said, bar counsel, what do we do in this situation? Bar counsel unequivocally said, you have to get off the case. They went to the court and sealed proceedings outside of the state. They said, here's the deal. Venisi has admitted X, Y, and Z to us. We can't go forward under these circumstances. We need off the case. District court said, you're not going to get off the case. As a last-ditch effort, then, Venisi stuck with people who were going to have to sit on their hands, came to the court and said, fine then, let me represent myself. I'll represent myself under Ferretta. And under somewhat dubious analysis, she said, well, I'm afraid that maybe you're going to disrupt these proceedings, even though there had been no evidence of that. And I think you're doing this for purpose of delay. Well, again, the purpose of delay, he had tried, and he and his counsel had tried to work out this problem. It was more than a month before trial. He finally said, fine, let me represent myself. She said no. As a result, he's between a hard rock and a hard place, and so are his counsel. They are forced to... What a structural error is a breakdown in the adversarial process, where the advocates do not subject the state's case to any kind of meaningful review. They did not put on an opening argument. They did not put on a closing argument. They did not put on any evidence. They did not subject any of the state's witnesses to any meaningful cross-examination. And as a matter of fact, with the vast majority of the witness, did not give any cross-examination at all.
Doesn't the record support that was done after thorough evaluation and consideration by the trial judge for each and every one of those instances?
I believe that the trial judge got around this issue by applying the wrong standard. The trial judge said, well, whatever happened, Venisi wasn't prejudiced because of the overwhelming evidence. My point being that under Chronic and the analysis there, you circumvent the Strickland two-prong standard. There are some instances in which the fundamental structure of the trial, of the advocacy process, breaks down. When you have attorneys, the Sixth Amendment affords you more than just the right to have an attorney sitting in trial. When that attorney or those attorneys are constrained by other conflicts, by actual conflicts, that is a constitutional error, and prejudice is presumed. And it matters not what their actual performance was or whether you can point to any specific instances of prejudice. Prejudice is presumed because it affects the integrity of our judicial system, because they were railroaded through with lawyers who were not able to effectively represent their interests and
counsel,
to address
the state's
case.
Counsel, wasn't some of that predicated, though, on Venisi's position or the allegation that he was going to perjure himself?
There is an allegation from the defense lawyers that he wanted them to put on perjured testimony. In my mind, the answer to that is if you can't resolve it in any other way, because I don't think it's appropriate to say we're afraid he's going to do the same thing to other lawyers so you can't get off. The problem is that these lawyers have to go away. These lawyers cannot effectively represent him. And if you're put in that position and you can't find anything else, what you do is what happened in McConnell. You say, fine, we'll allow you, if you qualify under Ferretta, to represent yourself, and we'll give you standby counsel. And then you...
So are you endorsing perjured testimony be admitted in the future?
No, I'm not endorsing perjured testimony. But if you have standby counsel, you don't even have that issue. The right to self-representation actually exceeds the right to counsel. And so...
But let's put it in position of this particular case. We have someone who's represented by his counsel. This allegation is made as to him wanting to offer testimony that's not true. His counsel says, I cannot accept this. So as you said, we now have this conflict.
But the conflict means the lawyers have to get off the case. That's my point exactly. These lawyers cannot represent him at this trial.
But is that a type of conflict that we wish to endorse?
It's the type of conflict we
that
have
the
to
counsel
acknowledge.
Has to pull out if he knows his client is going to make false statements. Is
he
that
knows
something
his client is
going
to make false statements. He has to get off the case, and I think that's
allow
the point.
It?
Huh?
And allow it, allow that
it's not,
fraud to come
it's,
to
it's
the
not
court?
Up to counsel to allow or not. He's saying, I can't do this. I've got an ethical conflict. I've got to get away, right? There are other mechanisms then to take care of or address the problem, including standby counsel, which doesn't have the same responsibilities that your counsel that is representing all of your interests there would.
All right, any other questions? We chewed into your rebuttal time, so I'm going to give you your 2 minutes.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court. I'm Terry McCarthy, Deputy DA from Washoe County, on behalf of the state. And by the way, when there was a mention earlier that counsel testified to X, Y, that their clients had X, Y, and Z, that X, Y, and Z is I intend to perjure myself. And counsel did respond, this court has already reviewed that. That was what was at issue on the direct appeal. So the question on that subject is, can somebody in Venice's position avoid trial for the rest of his life by simply telling every lawyer that comes in, I intend to perjure myself? Then those lawyers then cannot conduct the trial. Or should this court follow Nix versus Whiteside and say, when you're confronted with this, you do what you can, and if you can't get off the case, then you go ahead and do the best you can. The findings by the trial court is these lawyers did the best they can with what they had to work with. They admittedly did not do a lot. They did some cross-examination. They were involved in jury selection and the like. But the chronic standard mentioned by Mr. Qualls is wholly inappropriate. The U.S. Supreme Court has addressed that in Bell versus Cohn and said it's only when there's a complete denial of counsel, where there is no counsel acting at all. In that case only, then the petitioner is relieved of the obligation to show prejudice. That is not this case, because he had lawyers, and those lawyers were involved, and they're doing the best they can. Therefore, he has to show prejudice from counsel's failings. On that, there is a complete lack of evidence. There was not one word in the habeas hearing about what could have happened, what evidence could have been presented, how any witness would have answered any single question. So there's a total absence, not even a hint of prejudice attending this. And on that subject, I would remind the court, this court has already found that the evidence was overwhelming, and indeed it was. Moving on then to competency, there was a mention of Colombo, and Colombo, according to Mr. Qualls, dealt with the right to counsel. There's no right to counsel in Colombo. The question in Colombo was whether the prisoner was available to litigate on his own behalf due to his incompetence. This court, well, he said he was, but more importantly, the court also said the case could go on. If he was incompetent, the case could go on. If someone successfully invokes the jurisdiction of the district court, as did Venisi, by filing his petition, he raises a claim and he gets counsel appointed, his later claim of incompetence does not prevent resolving pleaded claims. It may become relevant later.
Counsel, how do we deal with the issue as presented, though? The ability to assist counsel during the pendency of the proceedings.
The district judge resolved that. By the way, Dr. Bicker, the psychiatrist, his testimony was pretty ambiguous on that subject. He said that Venisi lacked the motivation to assist counsel. I asked him, I read the transcript recently, does he have the ability to dig down into his brain to retrieve information and express it? The answer was unequivocally, yes, he does. What he lacks is the motivation to do so. Dr. Bicker made up a diagnosis. He admits that he can't find it in the DSM or anywhere else. It's called nihilistic delusions, the belief that nothing matters. That is motivation to assist, not ability to assist.
Mr. McCarthy, are you saying, I was listening to what you said, maybe I got it wrong, that if a person is incompetent at habeas proceedings, that you can still proceed even though they can't aid counsel?
Several courts have said so, yes.
And is that your position?
That is indeed my position. I also think the court needn't reach that because this fellow is competent. It was a finding by the trial court. But yes, we can go forward, resolve the claims that got pleaded before he became incompetent.
What do we do with the low IQ people, real low IQ, not necessarily, low IQ people? Do we treat them differently than this Venisa guy?
Well, we recognize that presents challenges for counsel. It makes it hard. That's why we get the big bucks. Wait a minute, we don't. Okay. And that's the finding in this case, too, is it made it difficult. Vannese's lack of motivation to assist his counsel, because he didn't care, made it difficult. It presented challenges for the lawyers. Those are not insurmountable challenges. They have to do the best they can with what they have to work with. If you have a client that won't cooperate, it's difficult, but it's what you have to live with. On the subject of providing competent counsel to people, I like to say that we can lead a horse to water, but you shouldn't shove his head under until he drowns. So we can provide someone with competent counsel, but we cannot, the state of Nevada cannot require that prisoner to take advantage of having counsel available to him.
In a non-capital case, if the person in their habeas petition alleges that they're incompetent, should we demand that counsel be appointed so that we can then do what you say and go ahead, even though the person's incompetent, handle the issues?
I think we ought to go forward. I think if they are able to successfully invoke the jurisdiction of the court, and we can resolve what they've raised. That's the claim here, remember. But
should we have to appoint counsel in that situation to make sure that the record's clean?
I don't think
so. So that you can't say there's an inadequate record?
I don't think so. I think the court may recall that there is no right, no constitutional right to state post-conviction proceedings at all. The only barrier is if the legislature allows it, the legislature cannot impose irrational barriers such as high filing fees or something, and we have no such fees. So if there is no right to the proceedings and there is no right to competent counsel, then the extent to which Nevada is going to allow the proceedings is up to the legislature. Our legislature has not said appoint counsel for every prisoner, and they have not said stop the proceedings if it appears the fellow is incompetent.
They have said, however, that counsel should be appointed where the claim is for ineffective assistance of counsel, at least a hearing for that purpose.
In a first post-conviction case, in a capital case, yes, indeed. There is a right to counsel and a statutory right to counsel. And that would seem to be required. Well,
but your point is that that's as far as the legislature has gone, that it isn't also necessary to require that the defendant maintain competency throughout the post-conviction proceedings in order for the court to conclude the adjudication.
That is indeed my position. There are several courts that have considered it before and after Rohan. Rohan, I believe, was wrongly decided. This court has dealt with the question of whether someone is competent to be executed, a fully different standard. The Rohan court said if you meet the standard of competence to stand trial, even though you're not standing trial, the upshot is you get an indefinite stay of execution. If we're going to stay execution, we ought to use that standard, the standard regarding the competency to be executed. So I think the Rohan court was just simply illogical. There are several cases cited in the briefs where that position was rejected. I cited the case involving the prisoner at Guantanamo Bay only because I found it interesting. But it is the trial court in D.C. But I suggest that those are the more appropriate cases. The Washington case indicates, what was it? Matter of Hughes, I believe, says go ahead and go forward with what has been pleaded, with the manner in which he invoked the jurisdiction of the court. Go ahead and resolve that. But make a record, as we did here, and determine, as a matter of fact, is he or is he not incompetent, because there may be another one. If he later claims, if he files a successive petition and claims, I could not raise all my claims because I was incompetent, then that court at that time will have an adequate record to decide whether he can raise new claims. That, I suggest, is the more appropriate standard than the...
So you're suggesting that it would be reviewed in the context of a second or perhaps supplemental petition?
If it ever arises, I agree. We can deal with it then. Although this court hinted in one of the Priscilla Ford opinions that that's not going to matter either, because claims are waived by not raising them, not by going involuntary waiver.
Let me ask you this. Mr. Qualls indicated that the judge's determination of competency wasn't supported by substantial evidence. Did you want to talk about that a little bit?
There was competing testimony. Dr. Amezaga said, I've examined him, and he's incompetent. Bitker said, I've examined him and found a diagnosis that I cannot find in any books. By some standard, he is incompetent. And the judge evaluated that and said, I like Amezaga. His was objective. And that's what our judges do, is they often have to choose between competing testimony. Now, on the subject of the so-called missing record, there's nothing offered in evidence. There was no order for the doctor to answer any specific questions. This is not new. I mean, psychologists don't reveal all the questions on the standardized test, you know, the MMPI and things like that. And if you find a psychologist testifying in front of the jury, you'll see the same thing where, well, doctor, you won't even tell me what questions you use, will you? And it's fine cross-examination, but it has nothing to do with review by this court. There was nothing offered in evidence that was refused. There was no order to produce. There was no nothing like that. And so what we have is a psychologist who is aggressively cross-examined, a psychiatrist who is aggressively cross-examined, and then a psychiatrist said that Venisi lacks only the motivation to assist his attorneys, not the ability. And the trier of fact reviewed those and said, I'm going with the guy that says he's competent. That's what they do. There's adequate evidence to support that conclusion. Mr. Qualls mentioned earlier, Dr. Bitker said that Venisi does not understand the proceedings. That's not so. There's no finding like that. There was no testimony like that. Bitker testified he does understand the proceedings. His only question was whether Venisi had the motivation, the desire to assist his attorneys. Because he lacked that motivation, Dr. Bitker made up a diagnosis of nihilistic delusions. It's an interesting interchange in the record is Dr. Bitker acknowledges that nihilism is customarily taught in the philosophy department, not the medical school at the university. But that was his diagnosis. So I suggest that there is adequate evidence, and there was competing evidence, at least to some degree, and the district court decided which was more credible. Now, the district court can indeed base its conclusion in part by its own evaluations. That's what they do. I mean, what happened when the first competency issues? If the fellow is able to respond to questions and things like that. So I suggest that there's no problem at all there on the question of competency. And if there was, and the question, if he was incompetent, that raises the interesting questions of what do we do next. But I don't think the court need resolve that because substantial evidence supports the conclusion of the district court. I see I've only got a couple minutes left. And this court's order indicated the issues to discuss. And by the way, I appreciate that a lot. I like this new proceeding. I had my first oral argument here 22 years ago, and this is the best innovation I've seen. But the order indicates we should discuss whether the McConnell error was harmless. You may not be surprised to find out. I wanted to discuss a little bit on whether there was McConnell error or not, or whether McConnell should be overruled. And I will simply say, if this court intended to forge a new path in McConnell, a new constitutional path, no one is following. On the subject of harmlessness, Brown versus Sanders gives a roadmap to what this court and the district courts have traditionally done. And as we've evaluated prejudice, we've evaluated harmlessness in several different contexts. The court said in Brown versus Sanders, let's think about what we're evaluating, what we're reweighing. We're reweighing the facts of the aggravating circumstances, not the conclusion, not the legal conclusion. I'm running out of time, so I have one quick example. Suppose you have an aggravating circumstance of a prior violent conviction. The jury can weigh whether that prior violent conviction was for murder or battery by a prisoner or assault on a softball referee. Those can be felonies. The jury weighs the facts, not the legal conclusion. The facts of the aggravating circumstances are unchanged. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Chief, could I ask Mr. McCarthy a question?
Sure.
Mr. McCarthy, this is kind of a tangential issue, but I'm interested in your opinion on that. We've had a number of cases recently or felony murder convictions, and the parties have used general verdict forms and not broken it down as to whether the jury finds the defendant guilty by premeditation, first-degree murder, or by felony murder. And we play this guessing game here in the Supreme Court trying to figure it out as to whether there was sufficient evidence for a premeditated first-degree murder. Should the court consider a rule where you segregate the forms, require a special verdict form in all felony murder cases so the jury can make a conclusion as whether it's a first-degree by premeditation versus by felony murder?
I think that would be something for the legislature to take up.
Okay. Well, that's why I'm just...
Yeah, I think that it would kind of undercut the ruling in Shad that murder is murder no matter how it is committed, and requiring special verdict forms would rather undercut that. So if the legislature asks my opinion, I'll tell them no, I don't think so.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right.
I'm going to go very fast. I urge you, first of all, to read the transcript at the competency hearings, Mr. Bitker, or Dr. Bitker's testimony, Dr. Amazaga's testimony. Dr. Bitker does find him incompetent. He does find him unable to understand certain aspects of the proceedings. What the court said in Crump was that if the statute requires counsel in post-conviction habeas, then the petitioner is entitled to effective assistance of counsel. That does bring in the constitutional standard. As for the idea that chronic and the standard of structural error only stands for the complete denial of counsel, that is simply not true. In Arizona v. Fulminante, it enumerates a number of ways in which structural error can occur, and two of those which are enumerated are include the denial of the right to self-representation and the complete denial of counsel. Now, of course, the complete denial of counsel, as far as counsel not sitting in the courtroom, hardly ever happens. But just because they're sitting in the courtroom doesn't rise to the level of the Sixth Amendment. Lastly, as to Brown v. Sanders simply was the wrong analysis here. What Brown v. Sanders says is that there's constitutional error, and I quote, only where the jury could not have given aggravating weight to the same facts and circumstances under the rubric of some other valid sentencing factor. The court or the jury could not permissibly have given aggravating weight, in this case, to the robbery and the facts of the robbery. Are the facts of the robbery presented to the jury? Of course they were, during the course of trial, and it was preceded upon, in part, the felony murder.
Go ahead and finish your thought.
Thank you. But the issue in Brown is whether the jury permissibly or impermissibly was allowed to, or whether they were allowed to give aggravating weight to those circumstances. And in this circumstance, under McConnell, they could not, it was impermissible for them to give aggravating weight to the facts and circumstances of the robbery, which was used in this case at the penalty phase. So even under Brown, it is an error. And
I was going to say, but what about Clemens versus Mississippi, where we have to reweigh? Aside from the factors of McConnell violation.
May I be permitted to respond to that?
Yes.
I believe that that is a legal fiction. A jury sits in the courtroom with the defendant. They watch him. They observe him. They get to know him, sometimes over weeks. They look him in the eye. They hear his voice even. He becomes human. A jury uses, especially under statute in the state of Nevada, uses a very subjective process. This is not a numbers game of weighing. So for an appellate court to be able to look at a cold record, never looking the defendant in the eye, and with absolutely no way to know what was in the hearts and minds and the subjective process of each one of those jurors, it is a legal fiction that reweighing is permissible under those circumstances, even under the statutes of the state of Nevada. It is impossible for an appellate court to know what was in the hearts and minds of those jurors, and to know, in this case, the death penalty rests upon three pillars. One of those is removed. It is impossible to know whether that house will still stand. Impossible to know. It only takes one juror. If it would have changed the minds of only one juror, and there's no way to know that, it has to go back for a new penalty phase.
All right, counsel, thank you for your excellent briefs and your arguments this morning. This matter will stand submitted.
Thank you.